dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war, of course, has at the moment one surpassingly large and dangerous adversary. It is Communist China. We have been talking a lot about it over the years on this program, notably since the start of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which I had the privilege of being the vice chairman of, about a year ago. And I'm very pleased to have one of its newest members with us to talk a little bit about the passion that she has had for some 60 years in her efforts to help the people of Tibet, one of the sovereign states that was conquered by and has been terribly treated ever since by the Chinese Communist Party. Her name is Mara Moynihan, and if that name sounds familiar, it's because her father was one of the great figures of our nation. His name, of course, was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He served in a number of capacities, including as our ambassador to India, our ambassador to the United Nations, a United States senator from New York, and, of course, has been very much a man we, I think, cherish the memory of, particularly those of us who are Scoop Jackson Democrats, as he was one of them back in the day. Mara, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome for the first time to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for your kind words about my late father, who was, of course, a very close friend of your ex-boss, the wonderful Scoop Jackson.
Indeed he was. They don't make them like those two men anymore, I think it's fair to say. Certainly not in the Democratic Party, alas. Mara, you have a number of, you know, credits that I should mention as well, including producing American Visionary, The Life of Patrick Moynihan. But I'm most interested in sort of talking about your experiences, the formative experiences in your life that have made the fight against what Communist China is up to such an abiding passion for you all these years.
Oh, yes. Well, it all started when I had the incredible good fortune to attend high school in New Delhi, India, in the early 1970s, when my father was appointed ambassador to India by President Richard Nixon, who was a man who changed my life, even though I never had the opportunity to meet him and thank him in person. And when I first arrived in India, I was the new kid in the international school, and I was trying to make friends, and I was invited to Himachal Pradesh in northern India, which is right by the Tibetan border, which is now the Chinese border since the Chinese communist occupation of Tibet. And as we drove up towards Himachal Pradesh, I saw road gangs, Tibetan refugees breaking rocks. And I thought, what is going on here? And then we got to Kulu Manali, and there were a lot of Tibetan monasteries and Tibetan refugees. And we went up to an old pass, had been for centuries linked to Tibet and India through the salt trade. And I saw Chinese soldiers with bayonets. So I asked my Indian friends, what are all these Tibetans doing here? And they said, well, China invaded their country and we have given them refuge, but we can't talk about it. I said, why not? I said, because in 1962, after the flight of the Dalai Lama to India in 1959, China invaded India. And it won. And so then I got made more Tibetan friends in my high school years. And then in 1975, we had a very rare opportunity, my father and brother and I, to visit Communist China during the Cultural Revolution, when Chairman Mao was still alive. This was January of 1975. We went to what was then called Peking. And it was a frightening sight. And it looked like what North Korea looks like today from video footage we've seen. Then I get back to the United States. I'm a freshman at Harvard. And my Asian studies professor tells me that China's a socialist miracle and Chairman Mao is the next Jesus Christ. I suggested that that was not the case, that it was a vicious police state. And I was attacked by my professor and others. And I have found it very difficult all these years to watch the appeasement and collaboration with Communist China that now brought us to this terribly dangerous moment with the pandemic, where, as you know, our friend Rosemary Gibson has written the book, China Rx, about how 90% of our medications are made there. So much of our supply chain was relocated there, which is devastating to the American people. And millions of jobs, paying jobs in America, went overseas to China, where the poor Chinese people work as slaves. And so I'm now wondering what's next.
Well, this is the point that we want to use as the jumping off point for our conversation about China today. And I'm very interested, as you look at it, as you have for many years, of course, in part, at least through the prism of Tibet. Could you just, to wrap up this segment, just say a few words about what's the current state of the Tibetan people? The tyranny, of course, of China is unabated, but is there still a Tibet to speak of? Is there still even a memory of what Tibet was?
Well, yes, indeed. And it's interesting. Yesterday was March 10th, which signifies the Tibetan uprising 61 years ago in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, when a rumor from PLA barracks of a plot to assassinate the Dalai Lama. Many high lamas have been assassinated in the same way by being invited to a puppet show and not being allowed to bring bodyguards.
And the Dalai Lama, of course, Mar, is the spiritual leader of Tibet, the Buddhist community there, right?
Oh, yes, of course. And he lives to this day in northern India, in Dharamshala, and the Indian government protects him with tremendous security. There have been many death threats from the Chinese Communist Party. And while we had a gathering in New York City yesterday and around the world, there were smaller March 10th gatherings, you don't hear much about Tibet anymore. And I worked for Radio Free Asia's Tibet service for many years. And that's because the repression has been very successful. There still are Tibetan people living in the Tibetan Autonomous Region and other parts of Tibet that were partitioned into the People's Republic of China. But the forced sinification has been so successful that the future of Tibetan culture really is a question right now. It depends what happens in China, and it depends what happens with the coronavirus. Will CCP come down or not? These questions remain to be answered.
They do indeed. Mara, we have to pause. When we come back, we will speak with Mara Moynihan about what is, in fact, the future prospect of communist China as we see it today, and what we might do to help it be other than more of the same or perhaps worse. That and more with Mara Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan's beloved daughter and the producer of a film about his life, American Visionary. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting, I'm very pleased to say, with Mara Moynihan. She is one of the newest members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Extraordinarily important group, I believe, in terms of addressing the present and indeed growing danger that communist China represents, both to us, to its own people, and to the world more generally. Mara has been following this closely, dating back to her days with her father when he was the U.S. ambassador to India, as we were just hearing about, and the important impact that had on her life as it prompted her to become aware of and engaged in the fight for Tibet's freedom from the Chinese communists. And Mara, we are witnessing, of course, 70 years of Chinese communist misrule, having done terrible things, not just to the Tibetans, but I would argue to people throughout China. And now, with the ambitions of the current dictator, Xi Jinping, to spread Chinese socialism or communism or imperialism, whatever you want to call it, around the world, it's threatening many, many more beyond China's own borders. Talk a little bit about how you see China today, both through the prism of what's going on with the coronavirus, if you wish, but more generally, what's happening there to the party and to the people of China?
Well, the world would be well advised to study the Chinese communist occupation of Tibet to understand that the Chinese Communist Party has for a long time now lied, broken treaties, broken promises. They forced the Tibetan government to sign the 17-point agreement on the peaceful liberation of Tibet, which was anything but peaceful. Almost 2 million people out of a population of 6 were slaughtered. The land has been decimated. And now we're in stage 3 of the Chinese communist occupation, which means we're at mines, hydro dams, and war games. Genghis Khan famously said, "He who controls Tibet controls the world." And if you go to Tibet, you can understand why when you're on that high plateau. And indeed, as the point you made earlier is very important, the Chinese people are also the victims of the Communist Party. And I do not consider Xi Jinping and the CCP the legitimate rulers of the Chinese people. And I always ask financiers and others in New York City and Washington who kind of believe in the Chimerica Project, which side are you on? Are you on the side of the Tiananmen students? Are you on the side of the Dalai Lama? Are you on the side of the Hong Kong protesters? Or are you on the side of Xi Jinping and the Politburo, which also is responsible for the deaths of 80 million Chinese people, according to a Princeton study? And I always get quizzical looks, and sometimes I get angry glares. But now they're all very concerned about losing money because the coronavirus has triggered, as you know, this terrible global pandemic and global financial crisis.
I'm so glad you brought this up about the financiers, Mara, because as you know, one of the focused lines of our effort in the Committee on the Present Danger of China has been to expose the degree to which American capital markets and therefore investors, both individual and most especially institutional investors like pension funds, are really underwriting and enabling what the Chinese Communist Party is doing across this broad front in terms of its brutal repression of its own people, as you've been discussing, but also in terms of its ambitions to enslave the rest of us. And I guess I would just ask, is there any doubt in your mind, as you say, we should study what they've done to Tibet, is there any doubt in your mind that having seen what they've done to the Tibetans and, for that matter, to the Chinese people, that they have very little likelihood of treating ours better? No?
I think the only difference is that we are half a planet away, and the poor Tibetans and the Chinese people are more easily vanquished because of geography. But I can remember in 2000, when I was working with Radio Free Asia, a white paper was leaked out of the Politburo that plainly stated that the Chinese Communist Party considered its biggest enemy the United States, but they were not going to use conventional warfare to conquer and defeat America. They were going to use stealth war, the name of General Spalding's excellent book. And that means economic warfare, espionage. And of course, there's many very disturbing reports coming out. A PLA general just tweeted a few days ago, "America's got the coronavirus, go ahead and die." And again, the finance crowd has for some years rolled their eyes and dismissed us when we've raised these very serious concerns.
I hope that they're going to do, but I'm not holding my breath, honestly. But it does seem to me to be one of the things that we should be very much pressing for is that they actually begin investing in America. Mara, as you've studied the Chinese Communist Party over all these years, and I certainly agree with you that they're not legitimate, but they have nonetheless clung to power very successfully. Is there a moment now, possibly, as a result of the combined effects of the steps that Donald Trump has taken, which have unmistakably weakened the Chinese economy, on the one hand, and the coronavirus, where there may be, you know, the possibility that some kind of change from this Communist Party's brutal repression could be in the offing? What do you think?
Well, that's an excellent question. And the one thing that a lot of Americans don't know, because mainstream media does not report accurately on China at all. I suppose you are compromised if you're the New York Times or the Washington Post and you're taking two-page color ads from Xinhua and China Daily every week. And they sort of always downplay the China threat, that what you referenced earlier about the appalling story of $500 billion of American pension funds getting invested into Hikvision, a People's Liberation Army surveillance stock. And I think most Americans have no idea that their broker on Wall Street wants to do this and is actually trying to do this. My question, and I've argued with many of these financiers in New York over the years, is which side are you on? Are you on America's side, or are you on the side of the Chinese Communist Party? Because you're certainly acting like you're on the side of the CCP. And so I wonder whether people in America are getting the right information. And I applaud you, Frank, for doing this radio show so people can start seeing the bigger picture on China. The accurate.
Well, thank you. And it's really, of course, the purpose of our committee on the present danger, China. And I'm so appreciative of your help with this effort as well, Mara. But the thing that we found in this national poll, a survey of 1,000 likely voters that was conducted for us at the end of January, before the coronavirus, you know, pandemic became evident as it is now, by the way. But we were talking through the pollster with, as I say, 1,000 likely voters. And it was clear that even though most of them didn't know a great deal about China, as evidenced by their responses to some of the questions and their responses when they learned a bit more about it, the sentiment, Mara, unmistakably, nonetheless, was deep concern about what China is up to. And the strong conviction that, again, was reinforced the more they knew, but the strong conviction that we needed a different course than this kind of business as usual, this kind of enabling of the Chinese Communist Party with our pension fund dollars and the like. And it was very heartening, and especially that it was evident across the demographic subgroups, not just, you know, some obvious candidates. So I think one must take heart from this, but let me just conclude by asking you, if you had President Trump's ear at this point, given what he's already done, what would you recommend he do now to further intensify the pressure on the Chinese Communist Party and help the people of Tibet and China and, well, the world for that matter?
Well, I would, of course, encourage him to listen to the brilliant Professor Peter Navarro, the author of the book Death by China and the excellent documentary film Death by China, which every American should see at once if they haven't already.
Peter Navarro, of course, having his ear as his trade advisor, right?
Yes, one of the most important people working in the American government today. Another thing that I have seen from my years at Radio Free Asia, I've spent years studying Chinese propaganda and Chinese Communist Party messaging. Well, they're already in overdrive mode, trying to spin culpability for the spread of the pandemic away from China and say it came from the United States. It's insane, but this is how they operate. And I would, if I was President Trump, I would hold a press conference and I would say, why hasn't the Chinese Communist Party been forthcoming with information? What's going on with the biological weapons laboratory in Wuhan, where it was the source of this pandemic? I would just call them out on it, because now they are spinning. Now the whole China hegemony project is at risk. Certainly Xi Jinping and the men in the Politburo know that. So they're desperately scrambling to hang on to power when the CCP is having their Titanic moment. They've hit the iceberg, and it's a terrible humanitarian crisis breaking out all over China. Of course, the death toll will probably be higher in China than anywhere else. But they've exported the pandemic, just as they have exported their authoritarianism and the normalization of the CCP, the normalization of a communist government that throws children into concentration camps because of their ethnicity or their parents' religion. And this has been a very, very dangerous trend. So if anything good comes out of this pandemic, it could be the weakening and the eventual collapse of the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese people can have a more inclusive and democratic form of government, such as the Hong Kong people have enjoyed, and the Taiwanese people. And this also puts a lie to the CCP belief that Chinese people are not suited for democracy. That's the lie that they've been peddling all these years. They need an authoritarian government. But we've seen in Hong Kong and Taiwan that Chinese people prosper without a communist government. So this is my hope, Frank.
Maura Moynihan, thank you so much for your time today. And you sounded like your old man, I have to say, just now. It was a very, very powerful exhortation for America to rise to this moment and to stand with the people who either, in the case of Taiwan and Hong Kong, are fighting for their freedom. And the case of the Chinese people, I'm sure, are yearning for it, everybody as much as the others. Maura, thank you so much for coming aboard. Come back to us again soon, if you would. And thank you for your work with the Committee on the Present Danger of China. Next up, we'll speak with Claudia Rosette. We'll talk a bit more about China and the coronavirus and what we are not doing about it here. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by one of the great investigative reporters and, well, freedom fighters of our time. Her name is Claudia Rosette. We have the privilege of speaking with her with some regularity, but she has been on a mission, I think it's fair to say, of late, covering closely, as she does always, totalitarian countries and regimes and their activities. Most especially, she has done so in her various media outlets, notably the Rosette Report at PJ Media. Claudia is also a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, but she draws on a lifetime of experience as a journalist, as an editorialist, much of it with the Wall Street Journal. Her reporting and writing has earned her the praise of her colleagues, including the Eric Brundell Award for breaking the UN Oil for Food Program and the Overseas Press Club Citation for Excellence for her reporting and commentary on the Tiananmen Square massacre. Claudia Rosette, it's always great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, we were talking in the previous segments with Maura Moynihan, Claudia, a bit about China and the nature of the party that runs it and the kinds of terrible things that that has entailed for the people of China, for the people of Tibet, and now increasingly for the rest of the world. I want to talk more about that with you in a moment. But before we get to that, there is a prism through which I think increasingly we're all looking at China, and that is the effects of this coronavirus. You've been studying it closely. Tell us what you make, Claudia, of how we've gotten to this pass and the culpability of the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, China very possibly could have stopped this at the source if they had a free society, open reporting, any sense of priority that did not put the Communist Party's image and grandiose ambitions and dreams first. What actually happened in China is cases began emerging there in Wuhan late last year. And doctors could see that this was a contagious and potentially very deadly disease, that in some cases there were really severe bad pneumonia that would come in. People began dying. And a set of doctors warned each other, it was actually a private chat room, to be careful treating these patients because this disease seemed to resemble SARS. And what happened was, since the Chinese Communist Party watches everybody, this was picked up by authorities. They were hauled in, warned that they were breaking the law, were spreading rumors. And one of the doctors, who then became sort of a folk hero in China among the illicit discussion online there, Dr. Li Wenliang, we particularly know about his case because he died of the virus in February. But he was forced to sign a document confessing that he had been a rumor monger, promising not to do it again, and went back to work, caught the virus, and died. So during these critical weeks, China first silenced doctors who tried to tell the truth about it. Then the communist authorities wanted to go ahead with their festivities, their Chinese New Year celebration, and so on. And so for much of January, there was no warning in Wuhan. In fact, they put out lies. The government assured people that there was no person-to-person transmission. It wasn't, you know, they said, it's not that bad, it's fine. In fact, there clearly was. And finally, just on the verge of New Year's, Chinese New Year's, as millions of people had already, migrant workers had already left Wuhan to go home to their villages in China, this thing was really beginning to spill out. And there were almost certainly thousands of cases already out there at that point. Finally, suddenly China turned around and realizing they had a problem that even they could not pretend away in propaganda, and slammed the gates on Wuhan, on Hubei province, where it's located, on 60 million and ultimately about 100 million people just in complete lockdown. And then China went into this great emergency mode. And then you began to see, this is very typical China Communist Party totalitarian tactics. They began sort of working the narrative in their propaganda. Briefly, there was a window where you could see the reality coming out of China because they lost control a bit over what was on the internet. And people in Wuhan were sending out these horrifying videos of bodies piling up, of desperate people screaming on balconies and so on. Then that kind of was all put back under the waves. You began to see videos of dancing patients and singing doctors and sunsets and self-sat, all this stuff. And then Xi Jinping, who vanished for the beginning of this, reappeared saying he was leading the people's war. It was now a people's war against the virus. And then loads of propaganda. Okay, we're almost to the... And then they sort of, the final shift in the propaganda narrative, they began blaming the emergence of the virus on the United States. This was not an official statement. It was insinuated, implied, hinted at, dropped into one thing after another, including one of their leading virologists sort of mentioning at a press conference, which got out through state propaganda, they made sure of that, that who knows where it really emerged. You know, that in fact, they were reprinting rumors, attributing them to Japanese press, which is a way of inserting this into the narrative, that the virus had been brought by the U.S. military to military games in Wuhan in October. So they have now sort of turned around the propaganda narrative. And with the help, I must say, of the World Health Organization, which is really in China's pocket if you watch how they behave. And the story now is, as China styles it, that China has been the hero and champion leading the way in the fight against this virus. Now it's spreading to the rest of the world. And on that basis, now that numbers in the United States have begun to soar, they're still in absolute terms small, but the trajectory is very high, from 100 about 2 weeks ago to more than 1,000 as we speak. Now the World Health Organization has declared a pandemic and gave a press conference in which they said that, in which they announced this, in which they thanked China for its, you know, mighty efforts to help contain this virus, and no thanks to the United States, which was shipping supplies to China, offered help that China refused to try and actually track down precisely what this emerged from. And so there you have it. That's the China propaganda narrative. It's Orwellian. It's horrifying. It's quite dangerous.
And it's quite dangerous. That's the point that I want to come back to, Claudia. But before we do, a sort of microcosm of this manipulation of the World Health Organization by the Chinese Communist Party, it would seem to me, is the fact that it's called the novel coronavirus-19 rather than the Wuhan flu or the Wuhan virus, you know, which is what would be sort of standard operating procedure when you identify these viruses, where they emerge. And you watch this press conference, Claudia, today, and I just wonder what your takeaway was from it in terms of the degree to which the Chinese are essentially now, well, and have been for some time, hamstringing the world's response to this problem by their determination to, you know, manipulate or dominate the international body that is supposed to, you know, help lead on such pandemics. And I'm struck by the report, and you might just comment on this too, if you would, that they're thinking about standing up their own international World Health Organization to compete with this one. That has to be putting pressure to bear on the WHO as well, no?
Yeah, if they did that, frankly, I'd say good, let them do it. And because right now, the way it works is we are the biggest, the United States is the biggest contributor to the WHO, and that China is the biggest exploiter of it. So that's not a good arrangement. I'd actually favor competition there. If China wants to go set it up a WHO of its own, by all means, I actually think the grounds on which, let them do that and people can decide which group camp they want to be in. I actually think that in confrontation with China, what matters most is that we have a strong military. We've got to be able to face them down and deter them. But as far as, you know, frankly, I think a WHO run by China would be a real misery to belong to. It would attract a lot of dictators. Let us set up the NATO equivalent in medicine, where you actually have the democracies get together and or the countries of goodwill are real friends. And I don't know. I can tell you which one I'd rather be treated by.
Well, yeah, I can too. And the point is that we have, in a way, the worst of both worlds at the moment, which is a WHO that is more or less run by the Chinese Communist Party. But it pretends to be, you know, a true international organization and therefore worthy of our very strong support. And Claudia, while we're on it, you have, as I mentioned, won international awards for your reporting on the UN. One of the things that the Chinese have been quite intent upon of late is really running quite a number of the UN organizations. I think there are four of them, and there was almost a fifth, the World Intellectual Property Organization, for heaven's sakes.
The Trump administration that they headed that off, and a Singapore person got that position, thank God, because putting China in charge of the UN organization that handles worldwide patents for intellectual property would be the final farce. I mean, this is probably the world's leading thieves of intellectual property, and to have them running that show, and it's in Geneva, so the press doesn't give it a lot of attention. It's been a site of endless scandals, actually, but because they could sort of incubate there and nobody really looks. But that was headed up. But yeah, China's been exploiting the UN for a long time, and that's what the UN invites. You know, it's got all these wonderful things. We basically bear the fixed costs. That's the sort of effective way it works. And other countries, the world's dictatorships, basically come in there and lick their fingers and eat the gravy. And China has, which is very good at spotting any opportunity like that, has been enjoying that for years.
Yeah, exploiting it and increasing their power thereby, let's be honest. Claudia, we have to pause for just a moment. More with the great Claudia Rosette straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are speaking with Claudia Rosette, a dear friend and colleague of many years who has done incalculably important work in her reporting and her editorials, some of it properly recognized by her peers in international journalism, and much of it really path-breaking for the rest of us, notably, but not exclusively, her extraordinary expose of how the UN was enabling Saddam Hussein to skirt sanctions and otherwise enrich himself and increase the threat that he posed to the rest of us. Claudia, we're talking about China, of course, and the coronavirus, and you have written in your column, I believe, and elsewhere, about the serious shortcomings in the response we've made to date to the coronavirus in this country. Talk a little bit about those as you see them and what you would recommend we be doing.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you that I have been incredibly horrified and disappointed by the performance of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But may I just put that in a framework? First, there was the China model, which the World Health Organization has been praising to the skies. And that's basically the totalitarian model, okay? Where how did they finally, once they finally admitted that they had an epidemic killer virus on their hands, how did they deal with it? Brutally, just cruelly and brutally. They disappeared bloggers who were writing about it when they didn't like what they were saying. They welded apartment building doors shut so families were in forced quarantine. They produced armed guards, and they just basically slammed in tens of millions, scores of millions, entire cities of people, whether or not they had adequate facilities or healthcare or anything else. And they went about it, if you didn't like it, you would get disappeared into prison, quarantine, you name it. That's the China model, okay? Brute force, censorship, and in the end, the Communist Party, they actually asked them to be thankful recently in Wuhan. The Communist Party tried introducing a gratitude education campaign, which even they couldn't quite force on people. People were so angry that they've had to sort of pull back on that. That's the China model, which the World Health Organization has been urging. Now, how should America deal with this? We're a free society. Our strong suit is not the China model. Our strong suit is free information, enterprise, creativity, all the things that freedom can give you that have made this country great. Well, the problem is we also have a large regulatory apparatus, and part of that is the Center for Disease Control, which is sounds really great, but actually has turned into a sprawling, large, sclerotic bureaucracy. And along with the Federal Drug Administration, the CDC, one of the things that America needed to do, Trump got it, let me just back up. President Trump did the right thing in January and truly did buy this country some time by imposing a travel ban on dealings with China. That helped slow the speed, which is critical. If you cannot finally contain this, you need to try and slow it down so your hospitals are not overwhelmed, so you learn what you're dealing with. That saves lives. Okay, critical to that is to test widely, easily, to just look everywhere you can anytime you think you have a case so you can tell people where is it going. Americans are resourceful people. Give Americans information and they'll figure out how to handle a lot of things. But in this case, the CDC prevented us having that information. They didn't just not help. They actively basically got in the way. They had a monopoly on testing. This is a big bureaucracy. And they produced failed test kits that didn't work well in early February, and then went on twiddling with these things for weeks. Well, this virus, clearly, we're not seeing it in the numbers, was spreading across the country, untracked, unchecked. People simply didn't know, you know, what where it was, where it was turning up. And finally, that logjam finally began to break up when President Trump appointed Vice President Pence on February 26th to head the coronavirus task force that you're now seeing daily on press conferences on the news. One of the first things, and it was critical, that Vice President Pence did was get rid of the CDC monopoly on testing, open it up, and start enlisting private companies to make these tests. The problem there is it takes a while to get that rolling. They're still dealing with regulatory red tape at the Food and Drug Administration. The CDC is still getting in the way on some of this. And basically, you've had this, frankly, I found it horrifying, this horrifying obstruction. And in the political fights that go on in Washington, I see that, you know, on the Democratic side, they'll do anything to beat up on the Trump administration. And at the same time, there's a great temptation on the right to say they're only doing this to beat up on the Trump administration. I think perhaps what really happened here is Democratic policies favor enormous regulation. You know, they've had candidates who really want nationalized health care. That's exactly the kind of thing that was the problem at the CDC. Enormous regulation, monopoly power over what are really basically test kits that are easy to make. The World Health Organization on Wednesday announced it had just shipped another 140,000 test kits to Iran. That's more test kits than Americans have had available to date. Okay? That's how bad the CDC failure was. It was colossal. And the answer to this is not, oh my God, we need a national health system. The answer to this is we need less regulation. So in a situation like this, people who really can fix it quickly, you know, my God, we're the country of big data. We invent a zillion things. If this had been turned over to entrepreneurs, here, solve this problem. We need test kits now. We need to track everyone in the country who might have it, you know, so we know where it's turning up. I think that could have been done incredibly fast. I mean, Amazon, Google, and Facebook know what you had for lunch yesterday by what you looked at online and bought. You know? So it's, could we use that to actually help with a thing like that?
No question, Claudia. This is one of those places where, as you say, American free enterprise would shine if it were turned loose. And I have to say, my wife has Lyme disease. And one of the things that we discovered in the course of trying to ascertain what it was that was making her sick in the first instance, and then, you know, how long she'd had it and so on, was a test that we were basically required to use that had been generated by things, immunologists at the Centers for Disease Control. And it turned out in that case, as I guess in the case of this test kit for the coronavirus, it had a very high false negative rate. And why on earth one would want to entrust any further the responsibility to folks who were seeing, really, I think quite clinically, as very derelict, is absolutely beyond me. But I think your point is well taken. We need to unleash the engines of our free economy to try to help address this problem. And so many others, by the way. We've got to get medicines back in this country, not made in China. We've got to get gloves and sterile gowns and the like to be able to deal with the fact of this disease.
You know, early in the epidemic in China, U.S. private groups were shipping huge amounts of supply, medical gear, protective gear to China. That's how good Americans are to help. And now we're short on that here. And we need to be thinking about what do we actually make sure we have available here, make here for security reasons. Okay, that runs counter to free market, but for security reasons. And for the rest, we need to be thinking about, my own view on this is, once this crisis has passed, there should be a cleaning out of the CDC. Somebody should really look through what on earth was going on, that bureaucrats, and this is, you can read this in press accounts that are not fake news, they're true, that bureaucrats within the CDC were busy emailing desperate authorities, doctors, hospitals, clinics in places like Washington State. Oh, sorry, I can't help you out. You know, you need to do the following 67 regulatory hoop jumps in order to get a test for someone who has clear symptoms of this disease. That's just wrong.
It is wrong. Claudia, let me, in the last couple of minutes we have, very quickly with you, ask you, is there, as we were talking about with Mara a moment ago, is there a chance that out of this pandemic, we may see a fatal weakening of the Communist Party of China and its hold on power?
I would not hold my breath. That would be a really good thing. The collapse of the Communist Party would solve a lot of problems for a lot of people in this world, us and the Chinese. But I'm sorry to say, I don't see that. I would be surprised. I think, you know, you never quite know. A spark can suddenly send up something, and it is a rotten structure in many ways. But there's one thing the Communist Party in China does really well, and that is hold on to power. They are very good at that.
I hope very much with your continuing terrific reporting, Claudia Rosette, that we will see the United States government making clear that it is not on the side of the totalitarian Communist Party of China. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.